Welcome to the New Civil Liberties Alliance and to our Lunch and Law series. Today we have the privilege to eavesdrop on a conversation between two friends, Peter Wallison and Christopher DeMuth. Peter serves on NCLA's Board of Advisors, but his full-time posting is as the Senior Fellow and Arthur F. Burns Fellow in Financial Policy Studies at AEI. He's a former General Counsel at the U.S. Treasury and former White House Counsel to President Reagan. Chris DeMuth is a distinguished fellow at the Hudson Institute. He's the former president of AEI and served as administrator for information and regulatory affairs at the Office of Management and Budget in President Reagan's first term. We are delighted to have Peter and Chris and the wealth of experience they bring in and out of government to today's topic. NCLA Senior Litigation Counsel Peggy Little will moderate today's talk on democracy in peril. Peggy.
Good afternoon. Today, we have two distinguished speakers with us today. Our topic addresses the problem that contentious issues of public policy that used to be the subject of hard and transparent choices by elected representatives are increasingly decided by unaccountable bureaucrats who rule through a profusion of regulations and enforcement that no one voted for and to which the courts defer. Peter Wallison will discuss the implications of unchecked administrative power on American democracy, where our original design provided that we would be governed by laws enacted by elected legislatures. He will argue that Article III courts must exercise fortitude to preserve the democratic structure that lies at the heart of American self-government. Chris DeMuth will offer perspectives from a recent article he published on Congress. And he will talk about the promise, or not, of the congressional empowerment and movement, as well as offering some thoughts about the European Union, where rise of declarative government, which is law dispensed by bureaucracies, has led to the decline in Europe of representative government, rule by an unelected elite, and what that means for political polarization and economic instability. Gentlemen.
Let me say a word first, okay, Chris? And that is that, well, first, thank you all for coming, and thanks to NCLA for putting on this program, which I'm delighted to participate in because I have been, as I was telling Peggy a moment ago, been all over the country trying to interest people in thinking about the issues that I raised in this book. And so if any of you have other places where you would like to hear about this book, just give me a call and I'll be glad to do it. Now, there's the book. I have asked Chris to go first on this because his article really raises in a much broader context than my book the same kinds of issues. And so I think Chris will probably give you a bigger picture, and then I will talk about a much narrower part of that picture, which it just happens my book actually covers. And Chris and I apparently have been thinking along the same lines for a long time, but I put it into a book and a narrower issue, and Chris has been thinking much more broadly. So thank you, Chris, for giving me this opportunity to explain things.
The notes that I wrote for myself for this talk begin, it is really humbling to follow Peter Wallison, who has written this magnificent book, A Real Landmark. It goes on and on in those forms, but he kind of pulled the rug out from under my all the nice things I was going to say about him, so I will go ahead. I am a lawyer, too. I practice law. Peter and I have had a lot of engagements with legal issues over the years. I tossed in an amicus brief in the Keyser case. You know, I'm kind of involved in these things. I follow what this wonderful new institution is doing with great admiration. Recently, I've been practicing political science and sociology without a license. And I have come up with some perspectives that are a little bit different, complementary to the work that you and that Peter have been doing, and I will talk about those. And Let me start with a stark formulation. I think that the modern administrative state that we are contending with is not primarily the result of an intellectual wrong turn, Woodrow Wilson progressivism a century ago or more, and it is not primarily the result of judicial wrong turns, the abandonment of the non-delegation doctrine, the Chevron and various related judicial deference doctrines. I think that those are all important, but it is important also to understand the larger context in which these changes took place, which to my mind are primarily economic, social, and actually technological. I think that the ultimate source of the administrative state is the tremendous growth in affluence, wealth, and leisure time. That's the first. I'll get to the second in a minute. In the past 50 years, the number of citizens who are actively engaged in politics, who follow politics, who are part of political organizations, has vastly increased. It used to be a very narrow sliver of society. Now it's very, very large numbers of people. They have the leisure time. There's been many more educated people are involved in trying to influence the course of government. And in a wealthy society, many new issues come up that were not personal health, occupational safety, environmental quality, personal dignity, identity, participation, access. These were not important issues or issues at all in national politics before about 30, 40 years ago. Now they have become live and important issues. The second is technological. Changes in transportation and primarily communications technology, beginning 30 or 40 years ago, with tremendous increases in facility in the past 10 years with the iPhone and the internet and so forth, have radically reduced the costs of political participation. On the demand side, people can discover each other, form networks, achieve self-identity, that, you know, something that they were grumbling about, enthusiastic about. There are other people that feel the same way all over the country, far away from their immediate communities. They can achieve self-awareness, march into the public square, march into the Congress with demands, proposals for policy. And on the supply side, politics has become atomized. It used to be mediated by big institutions, the parties, regional, city bosses in Congress, a strong committee structure with strong chairmen. That's all been disestablished. Political representatives are now primarily solo entrepreneurs. They can mount careers. They can participate in affinity and interest groups, raise money, and do not have to engage in the kind of difficult negotiation, bargaining, be mere cogs in a larger mechanism of collective choice, which was what politics used to be. So our politics has changed fundamentally. The first result of this was Congress was overwhelmed. It is a highly cumbersome, by design, institution. It works through committees. Committees make decisions very, very slowly. It has many encumbrances that the founders put there by design to make sure that national policy only comes into being when there's a pretty substantial and sustained nationwide consensus for action. It was completely unprepared for the profusion of new issues that came in my view, importantly, at about 1970 was when things began to change. It adopted the technique of radical delegation. Somebody would come in and they would be arguing about gender discrimination in the workplace. And they'd hear, you know, people, you know, arguing about it. This is going to take time. This is a complicated matter. Why don't we just give it to an agency, let them sort it out, and just tell them to go, we're against discrimination. You figure out what that means. You make the real law. Now, I understand that the administrative state had long existed before 1970 when we started creating all of these new agencies of social regulation. They were different kinds of agencies. If you look at the ICC or the CAB, they were concerned mainly with highly contained commercial disputes, with managing a cartel, for example. They mainly engaged in adjudication. Now, adjudication could amount to policy. I often make, the old agencies, they had a lot of discretion. The public convenience and necessity. Well, that's pretty broad and I would say unconstitutional delegation. But it operated within a very narrow ambit. Should a second trucking firm be able to haul artichokes from Castroville, California to Reno, Nevada? Those were the kind of decisions they made. Now, sometimes they amounted to policy over time. The CAB, in its dishonorable history from the mid-1930s to the late 1970s, did not allow a single new interstate aircraft carrier, passenger airplane company to enter any interstate market. So that was a policy. The policy was, this is a cartel for the incumbents, nobody else gets in. But it was the accumulation of decades and decades of decision making. The new agencies glommed on to this thing that was in the Administrative Procedure Act that nobody'd ever made much use of, informal rulemaking. And suddenly, beginning in the mid-1970s, they were making rules with hundreds of millions of dollars of impact, applied nationwide to many, many different agencies. There was no adjudication, there was no sparring of counsel, there was no expert witnesses. They just canvassed for memoranda and announced what the policy would be, often under very vague or hopelessly conflicting statutory standards. For me, the big change was not so much Chevron as the benzene case, which came 5 or 6 years before, where the statute seems in retrospect clearly unconstitutional. There were a bunch of different people in the House and Senate that had different ideas for what the standards for setting an occupational rule should be. And instead of negotiating a compromise, they just put all of them in. And the thing's a hodgepodge. Nobody understands what the operative policy of the OSHA statute is. But the arguments that I was involved in were all about the science and what standards should be set and how much this was a risk, how much occupational health risks benzene presented. It was all on the scientific side. I remember talking about the case with Professor Scalia at University of Chicago Law School. And the idea of the non-delegation doctrine never came up. We were regulatory reformers. We wanted OSHA to do the right thing, and it was often off doing a lot of stupid things. And thank goodness the courts were going to get involved. And he wrote a note about it afterwards where he was kind of surprised that Rehnquist had raised this idea of non-delegation. The overwhelming nature of these decisions, with mounds and mounds of scientific evidence and conflicting interpretations, were very, very difficult for the courts to deal with. I think that the emergence of informal rulemaking and its combination with this predecessor institutional feature of combining surveillance, enforcement, policymaking, adjudication, all within the same agency, created a fairly monstrous new form of government with a degree of power that we had never seen before, and that are very, very difficult for the courts to cope with. I want to say two things about this larger political structure that we have created before turning things over to Peter. First, I regard it as not simply a threat to constitutional structure, to the separation of powers, but a real threat to democracy itself. Traditionally, when law was made, it was by a representative legislature. And it wasn't just an accident that the framers put all of that into Article I and began the Constitution with Article I and were very clear about the powers that were to be exercised by representatives. Law would represent the full spectrum of political opinions in the society. It would be a matter of compromise, typically unprincipled compromise. It wouldn't be the kind of thing an administrative agency could do. As Justice Douglas once said, it is the nature of lawmaking that it's arbitrary and capricious. That's what it is. We have a lot of people with conflicting views, and they get together, and they come up with some sort of a compromise. That's what legislation is all about. We've developed this new form of government, which is declarative government as opposed to representative government. It represents the views of a very narrow spectrum of society. Now, you go to the EPA and you observe a fight between the Sierra Club and ExxonMobil. And, you know, it looks like we're having a real debate, but those people are all part of the same world. They're concerned with environmental quality. Specialized missionary agencies often do things that are acceptable to everybody at the table that couldn't come close to winning a majority vote in a bicameral, two majority votes in a bicameral legislature, because it departs from common sense in all sorts of ways. Peter, in another life before this book, as a student of the regulatory prelude to the financial collapse of 2008, can show you things that Fannie Mae and Freddie and HUD were doing that were profoundly risky and antisocial, that none of them really saw until they had engineered a terrible collapse. So it is my view that one of the keys to this big surprise that we've all faced in recent years, the Trump election, the Brexit vote, the emergence of nationalist governments in a lot of the peripheral nations of Europe, all of which shocked everybody when it came. I mean, sometimes the night the vote was counted was the first time people realized there had been this enormous shift. Why did this happen so quickly? And why has it been so, at the margins, violent, ugly? People thinking that people on the other side are fundamentally illegitimate. Important reason in my view is the problems that this association is dealing with. That is the rise of declarative government representing a very narrow spectrum of the society. And it is, whether you're for or against bump stocks, it is people who are relatively educated, mobile, networked, politically active. It is not the Trump coalition, to put it another way. People who are less educated, who spend less time in Washington, who live in their own local communities, they depend on the representative legislature. And if the last 30 years, much more of the progression in anti-discrimination or environmental or health and safety policy had been the work of a representative legislature, it would have been compromised. There would have been a lot of parochial decisions. It wouldn't have been as sort of rational and highfalutin as it has been, but it would have been much more stable politically. I think it's no accident that the two big issues that Trump seized upon in the campaign, immigration and tariffs, are two areas of really, really extreme delegation, where the executive branch has just been making policy on its own for decade after decade. And that once he got in, that deregulation, taking on the deep regulatory state, turned out to be one of his big issues. Shall I turn it over to you?
I think you should.
Okay. I think. Let me just say that I think that the changes that Peter advocates and that you are engaged in are absolutely critical. They are necessary conditions of reform to the fix that we have gotten ourselves into. But I think that there are larger political dynamics where we're going to have to make a direct effort to revive the constitutional prerogatives and jealousies of the legislative branch. So I regard what Peter's going to be talking about is absolutely essential, but I think it needs to be augmented by other more political approaches. Thank you. Peter.
Well, thank you very much, Chris. And I think you can see, if you've had a chance to look at the book, how similar Chris's analysis is to what is in the book. The book begins with this sentence, and that is, unless we can gain control of the administrative state, we are at risk of losing our democracy. And this is basically why I wrote this book, because I can see some real dangers on the horizon coming out of the fact that the rules for most people are now being made by an unelected group in and around Washington, D.C., reflecting the priorities of people in and around Washington, D.C., and not having very much to do with the views and priorities of people elsewhere. Now, the danger of that, as I saw it, is that eventually the legitimacy of the government is going to be challenged. Because people do believe, the American people do believe, that they live in a democracy. And what that means to them is that they have some opportunity to control the way their government behaves and the kinds of rules that the government makes for them. And to the extent that the rules that are coming out of the government are not those that many people would agree to or feel comfortable with is a major challenge. I cite, as Chris does in his discussion, I cite the Brexit case as being an example of what can happen here in the United States unless we are much more sensible about how we allow the rules to be made. Brexit was, to me, an example, a perfect example of what is going on in the United States, except for the fact that the EU is an organization that someone can withdraw from. Obviously, the American people cannot withdraw from the United States, and we certainly wouldn't want them to. But in this, there is the same element there, and that is in Brexit, people were in Britain were concerned that regulations and rules were being made in Brussels over which they had no significant control. And those regulations and rules under the EU aegis went directly into the laws of England. And that is not something that the people were comfortable with. And that's the reason, I think, that so many Britons, a majority, voted to withdraw from the EU. And what that was, essentially, was the a sense that the EU was an illegitimate government for Britain. What can happen in the United States is the same thing over a longer term. And when I looked at what happened with in the Trump election, we saw very much exactly that. They didn't articulate it the way as clearly as people articulated it in the Brexit case, but what they did was what the Trump supporters, the people who ultimately voted for him in this surprising populist uprising, as it was called, were people who felt that they were no longer being listened to by their government. And they were sending an important message about the fact that they were being ignored when they should have much more to say, in their view, about what their government does. So that was the first thing that interested me in looking into this whole issue and seeing how we could deal with it. Now, what we know about how the Constitution was formed, how the Constitution was framed by those who wrote it, is that they were very concerned about the possibility that the liberties of the American people would be restricted in some way by the government that they were establishing. So they start off with the idea of separating the powers. And why did they do that? Why did they put all of the legislative authority in Congress and leave the president out of the legislative process entirely, and then said the president had the authority to enforce the laws, but not any authority to make the laws, and finally the judiciary had the opportunity to interpret the laws. So the purpose here, I think, pretty clearly, was that the framers thought that the danger to liberty occurred, tyranny was possible, where the same group or person had the opportunity both to make the law and to enforce the law. And that is what is the essence of our Constitution. The two are supposed to be separated. And what we are seeing over time is that these two powers are coming together in the form of this administrative state, because the same people now are getting the authority to make the law, make the rules, and to enforce the rules that they are making. And so it is a violation, a clear violation, of the very idea that underlies our Constitution. Well, how do we deal with this? Do we simply leave things the way they are? Do we try to get the Congress to be more interested in holding on to its own powers and making more laws, more specific laws that would keep the administrative agencies from having so much discretion? We could try that, but I don't think it's going to work. The problem is that Congress is unable and has incentives to avoid making these very difficult decisions. If they can turn the decision over to an administrative agency, they can tell their constituents that they have solved the problem. Let's take the Clean Water Act. The Congress said, basically, set a goal. The agency had to produce rules that would clean up the water in the United States. But what they didn't do was decide who was going to bear the burden of this, who was going to pay the cost, who was going to get the benefits. Those were not decisions that Congress made. And yet those are the decisions that a legislature in any free society would be empowered to make. This is how you take the power or the benefits from one group and turn it over to another group. That's what a legislature does and is empowered to do. But that's not what the legislature in the United States was actually doing in this case. It was turning over everything to a group of people who were supposed to be expert. Maybe they are, maybe they are not, but they were given the authority to make these very significant rules for the American people without Congress having instructed them in who was to be benefited and who was to be burdened. So in thinking about how we could address this, it seemed to me the only way to do this in a sensible way that was likely to work was to enlist the courts. And one of the things that I found as in doing my research in this area is that the judiciary was actually expected by the framers to have a much bigger role in defending the Constitution. I've cited in the book Federalist 78, which was written by Alexander Hamilton. And in the book, Hamilton says that the judiciary is supposed to be the guardians of the Constitution. And they were given lifetime tenure in the Constitution because that would allow them to have or encourage them to have the fortitude to step in when the separation of powers or the basic structure of the Constitution was being challenged by the elected branches. Unfortunately, they have not stepped in to do this. In 1935, after many changes occurred under the New Deal in the relationships between Congress and the president, and Congress was beginning to give much more authority to the administrative agencies and the president than they had ever done before, the courts did, in fact, step in. The Supreme Court declared two laws to be unconstitutional delegations of legislative authority to the president. But unfortunately, in the election of 1936, Roosevelt won a huge majority in Congress and a smashing victory in the presidential election, and then retaliated against the court, saying that, proposing that there would be he would have the power, Congress would give him the power to appoint seven new justices of the Supreme Court. And to the extent that that was approved by Congress, there's no constitutional problem with that. Congress has the power to decide how many members there should be of the Supreme Court. If that were to happen, then Roosevelt would have had the opportunity to take control of the court. Now, that was not popular with the people, and Congress did not adopt that, of course. But what it did do was cow the court. The court recognized that they had stepped into something that was a political trap and nightmare for them and a danger to the court. And so they stepped back. And from that point on, we have never had a case where the courts have tried to restrict the delegation of authority of legislative authority from the Congress to the executive branch. And the problem with that, of course, is that it is a violation of the separation of powers, and one that will just continue unless we adopt some way of controlling it. And from my perspective, the only way that is actually going to work is not going to be to ask Congress to resuscitate itself. The incentives for them are too difficult, but rather to get the courts back involved in the question of delegation of legislative authority. And I think that can be done fairly easily if the courts begin to understand, begin to look at the delegation of legislative authority as a problem for them, a responsibility that the framers placed on them. And I don't think we are too far from that right now, because we now have on the court, I believe, five members who are constitutionalists and see the importance of the separation of powers and see the importance of making sure that legislative actions are taken by Congress and not delegated to the administrative branch. Everything, I think, that I've been talking about now is recognized by the five members of the court, led, in fact, by Justice Thomas, who has talked about this for years and years, but also by the other four members, including the Chief Justice, who in a 2013 case actually recited exactly what Hamilton had said in Federalist 78. He said it is important for the courts to fulfill and remain within their areas of responsibility, but also to make sure that the other branches of the government remain within theirs. And so that is really a restatement of exactly what Hamilton was getting at in 78, Federalist 78. So I'm quite hopeful that when the court does begin to deal with these issues, and it has one before it right now in the so-called Gundy case, when they begin to deal with this issue, they will begin to take back a lot of the authority that has been allowed to Congress in delegating legislative authority to the two administrative agencies. I'm hopeful that when we see the Gundy decision, it will begin what I call in the book a jurisprudence of non-delegation, where they will try to decide what are the kinds of decisions that a legislature has to make and what are the kinds of decisions that it is okay for Congress to delegate or to assign to an administrative agency to do. They do this all the time in other areas. For example, just one example, and that is the question of what is an unconstitutional search and seizure. That has been dealt with over the years by the court in a jurisprudence in which they look at individual facts and they talk about what makes this an unconstitutional delegation, an unconstitutional search and seizure, and what does not. And they've done this sufficiently so that even police can be instructed now on what they do when they stop an automobile. So that's what we're missing. That's what I'm hoping the courts will do. And the book was written, hopefully, to tell the courts that they have this responsibility. They are the only ones who are going to be able to make the important changes that are necessary, and that they have in front of them and will have in front of them cases that will enable them to decide what is a legislative action and what is simply an administrative action.
We're at the 30-minute mark, and I have a question I'm going to direct to either one of you, which is picking up on that theme, the Gundy theme. Gundy comes up in the criminal law context, as you probably know, and your search and seizure example does. Do you have any thoughts or ideas about how delegation might be brought before the court in the civil context or having to do with the administrative agencies outside of the criminal law context?
Yeah, I mean, I don't see that there's much difference between a civil or a criminal case. Criminal cases are just much more restricted in terms of what you allow the agencies or even the Congress to do. But a civil case is raises the same kinds of issues. And the question, the really difficult question for the courts is how do you decide what is the important question that has to be decided by a Congress as compared to the question that, relatively minor question that can be decided by an administrative agency. Unfortunately, we have very little guidance on this. The first time this case arose was in 1823 when Chief Justice Marshall was facing a question of the first case of an unconstitutional delegation. And he said, well, Congress can delegate to administrative agencies the things that it could otherwise do. That's not a problem. But Congress must always make the important decisions. And that has never been judicially considered. And in a jurisprudence in which the Supreme Court itself begins to describe, outline what it is that makes a decision important and has to be done by Congress. So I don't see that there's a difference between a criminal and a civil case. It's simply a question of making a decision about what is important for Congress to decide and what they can delegate or hand over to an administrative agency.
I think that the... I hope that they decide Gundy in time for your session. I think that they might not decide it until July 1st. Clearly, they're spending a lot of time on it. I think it's an advent. I think it will be a first step back to reviving the non-delegation doctrine. I think it's a great advantage, not so much that it's criminal rather than civil, but that the nature of the case and this extraordinary authority given to the Attorney General and the caption of the case is not going to be AFDC versus Chevron. You know, there's not the Sierra Club versus oil. It's not part of the administrative law structure. It will be, I think, a small step, and I think the reason that it's taking so much time is that all of the justices understand that this is going to be a step towards developing a new jurisprudence. And, you know, I think that they don't want to decide this case on terms that make the Federal Reserve Board unconstitutional. You know, just, oh, we hadn't thought of that. I'm sure that on both sides, people are thinking ahead several steps, and that's the reason it's taking so much time. But I think it will be a small step, and then you will see more cases like the American Trucking case, which are kind of traditional, you know, right in the administrative state regulatory apparatus, where there will be challenges to specific statutes and efforts to draw analogies to how the court interprets the statute in the Gundy case.
Let me ask a question.
Yes.
What you both say makes a lot of sense. But the reality is that we currently have an extremely partisan, do-nothing Congress that the public holds in very low esteem. How do you factor that into the idea that a robust non-delegation doctrine would result in a revival of Congress assuming responsibility for setting policy and implementing it in a more detailed way? And also, how do you factor federalism into your thinking?
Well, just to respond to the first part of the question, and that is this issue of how you get Congress to begin acting like a legislature, I think that that is something the courts can do, and that's how I express it in the book. Because there are issues that the American people want to be resolved, and if what the courts tell Congress is that if you delegate too much authority to an administrative agency, we are going to declare those laws to be invalid, then Congress will have to begin to consider how it can structure laws so that they will pass the test that the Supreme Court has created. At least I've been in the government a little bit, Chris has been in the government, and you can see how the agencies respond to things like that. Because once they have been told that a law from Congress might be considered unconstitutional because it delegates too much authority to the agency, both Congress and the agencies will begin to consider much more deeply what decisions they are making. The Congress, whether it is passing too much authority to the agencies, and in the case of the agency, the question of whether it is going beyond what Congress has authorized it to do. Both of those involve the separation of powers and the problem of the administrative agency going beyond, well, first, in the first case, Congress giving too much power to the agency, and in the second case, the agency going beyond what Congress actually gave it in the way of power. So I think that the courts, and I express this in the book, the courts, the judiciary, has the power to stop these things from happening by starting to make clear where Congress must make decisions and where the agencies can take the decisions that Congress makes.
I'd say three things. First, I regard the paralysis and hyperpartisanship of the Congress as being in part a result, not a cause, of the problems of the growth of the administrative state, that the Congress has been able to free itself from the necessity of negotiation and compromise. The hard decisions are made downtown, so the members of Congress can kind of strut and fret on the stage and take strong positions because they're not actually the decision makers. And we tend to think of it as being beholden to these two partisan parties, but actually the parties are very weak. It is because Congress has become atomized that you get narrower groups. The Tea Party runs the Republican Party during the Obama years. Now the progressive left, the resistance, is exerting an undue influence over the Democrats in coping with the Trump administration. You know, if you ask the public opinions on Congress, I mean, they're way down in the basement with the press and drug traffickers and so forth. But if you ask, who do you think should make the laws? Should it be regulatory agencies or should it be the Congress? Everybody says the Congress. So, I mean, it's not as if people don't have some understanding that these guys have a job to do. I think that we're trying to square a circle here and trying to find a way to break in. And I think that Peter Wallison, in his talk, in his book, he's absolutely right. The big moment of opportunity now is with the non-delegation and the judicial deference doctrines. We can't expect, and I know Peter doesn't expect, Congress to be cooperative about this. They're not going to go, oh, I hadn't thought about that. Oh, I'm supposed to make the law. Now I understand. Thank you so much, Your Honor. So, you know, let's get together and make a law. However, imagine if the court held that that the executive branch did not have the authority to ban bump stocks. Now that is something Congress really, really didn't want to decide that. They were really, really happy to have it decided downtown. I think that President Trump missed a big, he's thrown some things back at Congress. He clearly should have thrown that one back to Congress. That's a great opportunity for them to, it'll be controversial, but they're going to do it. I mean, on the merits of the case and popular opinions over, Congress would take that statutory step, I think. And we've got to give them some baby steps, you know, to kind of, you know, confidence, you know, building confidence. They actually can make laws. So that would be a case where I can imagine if it went, if it were held unconstitutional, the arguments that you all have been making were accepted. But they might not be. I mean, it's a there are arguments this way and that. I'm for starting to put these things to Congress. I'd like to see the president do it too. I'd like to see a sort of a coordinated approach. That's why we might be heading to something that may turn out right on bump stocks and putting it back to Congress. I would have much preferred for the president to do it himself rather than leaving it to the bureaucracy and to the courts. So I'm for a two-pronged attack on getting Congress to pull up its socks and be a legislature again.
Thank you, Peggy, for the forum. The question first goes to Chris, because as I understand Peter's argument about fortitude for the judiciary, there's a great deal of confidence that judges and the justices can overcome some of those public choice dynamics and show the fortitude necessary to create and extend this doctrine. I want to ask you about your confidence in that, because it seems there is a tension, especially with the Chief Justice, a tension that exists between charting this course and reigning in the administrative state and upholding and promoting the court as a body that has integrity and respect in our society, even on controversial issues. And my evidence for concern would be King v. Burwell, where a tax issue was placed at HHS because potentially the chief did not see a role for being controversial. How confident are you in the fortitude that can come forward?
I agree with everything you said. I think there are a lot of uncertainties, and you know, all I can say is we'll see. The NCLA has been teeing up a lot of great cases. That some of these things are going to find their way to the court, and you know, I can cite three or four things that the chief has said that shows that he's very, very much concerned about the dynamics of the administrative state, and I think we're going to see two cases, Kizor and the Gundy case this year, and I regard those as both kind of tiny steps. I'm pretty optimistic in both cases. I may be wrong. I would like to see bump stocks could be a nice case for Congress. I'd like to see the court take some steps in these two fields that seemed really controversial, and then they find out the next day that they're still there, and some people are actually saying, yeah, actually Congress ought to do this, and all the editorials are directed not at the court but at Congress. I mean, the judicial decisions that Peter is talking about are not the end of the road for the policies in question. They're just saying that the wrong people decided it. It ought to be decided by the representative legislature. To throw something back to the legislature and say, you guys never decided this. This is a big issue. You have to decide it. It doesn't seem to me like something where people are going to rise up and say, that's illegitimate. Who do those guys think they are? It's not that sort of a thing. The tincture of illegitimacy that our government has right now is in excessive power in the bureaucracy and excessive passivity in the legislature. So I tend to be optimistic that I think if they start down this road, Peter gives the example of searches and seizures. We know where they're looking at particular issues and coming up with a non-delegation jurisprudence. I don't think that the legitimacy of the court, I have to say, the Schechter case, it was a unanimous decision. Cardozo, the liberals were all in favor of that. And, it caused some problems in the time. But the NRA went away, and that didn't, the New Deal kind of kept chugging along. So,
we
can argue about this, but we're about to find out. I mean, we're going to find out some interesting things in the next couple months.
Well, let me just add something to the question, because the King and Burwell issue, of course, has bothered everybody because the chief backed away from a decision that seemed to be something he should have participated in. But there's a lot of difference between a statutory interpretation and a decision about the structure of the Constitution. And Scalia made a lot out of the issue of, and he wasn't the first, but he talked about it a lot of the an issue about the courts getting involved in policy decisions. And I think that what this chief did in King versus Burwell is much more like the court getting involved in the policy decision, whereas a decision about non-delegation is about the structure of the Constitution, which is what the judiciary was given as an assignment by the framers. That's the argument I made in the book. And so that is not a violation of judicial restraint. It is something that the judiciary must take on under under the constitutional structure that they were left with by the framers.
I just want to add a comment and maybe solicit some thoughts too. One of the devices that is used when it comes up that Congress, it's hard to save Congress from itself, is this idea of complexity. You heard it in Justice Breyer's comments in the Keyser case about moieties. And yet, Peter talks about the fact that in search and seizure cases, Congress can, rather the court, can get into some rather detailed analysis. One of my favorite observations is by P.J. O'Rourke, who once observed that after a certain point, complexity is fraud. And it does seem to me in this context, and I offer this just as an observation, that when the topic of complexity comes up, whether it be Clean Water Act or the healthcare decisions or whatever, that complexity seems to be a smokescreen to say delegate it to an administrative agency. And I think there needs to be, in addition to the court decisions, some public education on this topic of complexity. These things need to be decided by Congress, and they are not too complex for a Congress to decide. They just need to do it.
Well, as Chief Justice Marshall said, the Congress has to make the important decisions, and the complexity of the decision is not a question of its importance. It's a question of the details. And so I think a lot of decisions that are left to the administrative agencies are details. In fact, I actually think that in the Chevron case, the court could have treated that as a detail. The question of whether, in the Chevron case, whether a single entity or a bubble, that is a whole group of entities together producing for a single company a certain amount of pollution, could have been treated by the court as simply a detail. And it's not something that the courts have to get involved in. For some reason, the court chose that case to make a stand on the issue of what can be delegated, or what can be decided by an administrative agency. But it didn't have to be. And so the major issue in that case was really whether Congress was entitled to make the rules on clean air, authorize an agency to go forward with rules on clean air, but also to decide at the same time who is going to be responsible for cleaning up and who's going to pay the cost of that and who is going to get the benefits of that. Those are the kinds of decisions that legislatures should make, and everything else is simply a detail.
I had a question over here.
Yes. Chris, you talked about political solutions in addition to legal judicial solutions. So in recent years, Congress tried to pass the RAINS Act to require that regulations be approved by Congress, and as I think you may know, I'm involved in an effort that's backed by 29 state legislative chambers to do what states did when they persuaded Congress to propose the Bill of Rights and presidential term limits, which is to persuade Congress to propose a constitutional amendment or at least pass some kind of a law that would require that regulations be approved by Congress. And all of these would require that the public decide that this issue is important enough to vote on, and I wonder, what do you think the prospects are for making the public see that maybe the most important trend right now in American law is this trend away that you describe, the trend away from representative government to, shall we say, edict-driven government. How do you think we get that done in the next 2 years? Or is it even possible to get the public to notice this and force perhaps some kind of political action?
Well, it's that's the largest question in politics, but it's a difficult question just in a seminar to say, you know, it's not as if, well, I've got a constitutional amendment that's better than yours, and if we could just get it on the network news, America would rise up. And, you know, most people, one of the things about a democracy like ours is that we want to have a government where people don't have to pay that much attention to politics. They can pay attention to their personal lives and things that are more important. As I do believe that these nationalist uprisings in the UK, in the United States, have been importantly informed by people's frustration, especially people that feel that they've kind of been left out. And I think that leadership is important. I think Trump's done some things right, but I think that he could be doing much more. I think the bump stock was an important missed opportunity, for example. But I think that when people see that the federal government is making rules on transgendered bathroom signs, I think a lot of people think, well, why is that being done in Washington? I mean, why can't the school board do this? You know, I'm on the school. I go to the PTA meetings, and we decide things like this all the time. Why has this become nationalized? Why are we going to have one rule for 300 million people? It just doesn't make any sense. And you know, that was one case that was kind of very much a part of political controversy. And so I think that when you get cases of overreach, vulnerability, these bureaucracies aim to do that. And I can see several things that the current agencies are doing that would be liable to attack. So I don't have an answer to it. I do think that the anger in our politics is in part because we have this form of government that is by edict, which is a very it's an unstable one. It doesn't sit well with our political traditions. And I'm in addition to the judicial work, I want to insert these things more into legislative politics, into presidential politics, and I'm always looking for opportunities for it. But I think that it's a difficult matter, and you know, I'm a scribbler, and it requires leadership. And Peter, you?
The separation of powers was intended to do the kind of protection of people's liberties that you are talking about. The only way to make sure that the people's liberties are protected is to make sure that the laws are made by a body that represents all the people, and that is the Congress. The danger is that unless we find a way to force the laws to be made by Congress instead of what is happening now, is that we will gradually continue to drift into a system in which the rules, the laws, are made by an unelected group, and then there is no protection for people's liberties. And that's exactly what the framers were dealing with 200 years ago. So, 250 years ago. So, you put your finger on a very important question here, and it's not just democracy, which is important, but also how do we protect people's liberties? And that was the lodestone the lodestar for what the framers were trying to address in the Constitution.
I would actually add to that this problem exists in the states as well, in state governments. You will find state administrative agencies also going beyond their powers. And that leads to a lot of the frustration here. We haven't addressed that because we've been talking about Congress, but it is certainly not confined just to the federal level.
Right.
We are out of time. We thank you very much for coming. We thank our speakers.
Thank you, Peggy.
We were very honored to have you.